Radio Influence, podcasting redefined.
This is Landry Football on Radio Influence, the only podcast where you can get perspective of what happened on the gridiron through the eyes of a coach, scout, and front office administrator. Now, it's time to step into the film room. Here's Chris Landry.
Happy Tuesday, everyone. Pleasure to join you for this February 5th edition of the Landry Football Podcast. A little melancholy in that we switch over as no football games are on the tap anymore. We're all done for football game season. Of course, for me, and the grinding of the tape continues 12 months a year. I admit, even I have a lull in my life when I can anticipate the weekend coming and there are football games, meaningful football games, where we don't know who won and who's going to win, and we break it down and get excited for it, just like everyone else in that regard. But, hey, I hope you enjoyed the Super Bowl. Did you enjoy it? A lot of people think it was boring. A lot of people talking about it's one of the worst Super Bowls. I guess it's a matter of perspective. I tweeted out during the course of the game that I don't think there's an appreciation for football, particularly for the average fan. The fan that maybe watches the Super Bowl needs to be entertained by some alternative, you know, way. Excitement, splash plays. I think that's where we are in society today. We're in a highlight society. We're in a do something to just make me, you know, look away from my cell phone society. I don't think there's a real appreciation for football. And of course, I think most people that listen to this podcast, at least the feedback that I get from your questions, from your comments, it's a very intelligent group that knows football, that has an appreciation for football. I enjoyed the game. I thought it was very good. Listen, anytime you have a game that's low scoring, that's a defensive game, the offenses are not going to play well. That's kind of the way it works. When you have a defensive-oriented game, it forces the offense to make mistakes. I think people missed it. Jared Goff sucked, and, you know, it was really bad, and where was that Rams offense? Well, we're going to get into it. I'm going to explain to you what happened and why they look so bad, and what the Patriot did to make them look bad, and to some degree, what the Rams did against the Patriots, because the Patriots' offense didn't light it on fire. I think we all know, as everyone, I think, is in agreement, Tom Brady is in a league of its own. He didn't have a great game. Far from it. He didn't have a good game by anybody's standards, much less his standards. And he didn't have that type of game, a very good game against the Chiefs. But they were able to play good team football, and Brady, like he did against the Chiefs, once again did what he needed to do to make plays when he had to. When the game became tied, you could see it. It started to work, and maybe things that he wasn't willing to do in the early part of the game, the middle part of the game, he felt the need, first of all, out of necessity, but he has that gene in him to make just the one or two play. And that's kind of where he is in his career. He's still functioning well. And as I see this Patriots team involved, and look, when I left the Titans, after we kind of built that, we were involved in the Oilers / Titans and building that roster. And when we moved back home to look after my dad and my mom, Belichick hired me to do some consulting work and have done a lot of work for him. And when at that time, and I'm talking about now 2000, there was a lot of work being done that was building off of some things he initially did. In 2001, of course, is when they won their first Super Bowl against the Rams in New Orleans. And the year that Brady took over for Bledsoe, and this whole thing started. It was the year they won the Tuck Rule game and all the controversy that came along with that. But what I've noticed is in the early stages, they played well around and kind of did things around Brady that could help him, but he still was able to make plays, but he wasn't, you know, quite the quarterback that he became. Then he moved on and he became, in the middle part of this run, the guy. If you think about it, and I'm going to get into an interesting stat in a minute or during the course of this podcast, they got to where they became an elite offense. And Brady's just chunking it all around and here and there. And it is incredible to see what type of offensive team they became and how they became more pass and spread people out, work it horizontally, work vertically. Look how many deep balls they threw that year to Moss. I mean, it was just unbelievable. Well, as Brady's game is kind of, boy, I hate to use the term eroded. That's exactly what Tommy likes to hear, you know, to motivate him. His skills physically have eroded. He doesn't throw it deep as well as he did. Well, what do? They work the tight ends. They work the backs. They work the slot receivers. They work the horizontal passing game. You know, Brady, by his design, by Bill's design, has continued to be great, but has been great differently. It's looked differently through the course of years because of how they work the run game and the pass game, their personnel groupings, where they attack the defense. They do it differently by necessity, and they're still doing it. This is kind of evolved now towards a team that needs a little more help for Brady, and they're adjusting again. Listen, when I say it's fun to watch, I don't pull for anybody, although obviously I've had a lot of background consulting with them, but I've done a lot of consulting work for a lot of teams. So it's not like, you know, I'm, you know, pulling for people, rooting for people. I root for people, but I root for a lot of people. But I enjoy the strategy and the appreciation for what they do. I don't expect fans to like it unless they're Patriots fans and to enjoy it. But to me, if you don't at least have an appreciation for what they do and how they do it and how they're able to maneuver this and that, then I think you're kind of personally, I think you're kind of missing the boat as to what it is that makes them special. And if you're a football gym rat, a football nerd as I am, then you become ingratiated with the strategy, the personnel, the matchups, and how you're able to do it. So I thought it was a really good game in terms of the strategy. It also was a close game, despite the fact that, you know, all the things that we're talking about, and all hail to the Patriots and Bill and Brady. Look, we're talking about a mistake here or a big play there. And the Rams are right there to win the game. If you look at all the Patriots Super Bowls, all nine of them under the Belichick-Brady era. Remember, the Patriots went to two Super Bowls pre-Belichick. One was played against the 85 Bears, the Raymond Berry Patriots. They were never in that game, of course. And then, of course, the Parcells Patriots, which Belichick is on the staff, by the way, lost to Green Bay and Favre. That was, again, clearly Packers' better team. But of the nine Super Bowls that the Patriots have played in, with Brady and Belichick, you can make the case. You can look at them, study them. The outcome could have been the opposite of what they were. I'm not talking about the play itself, but the result could have been the opposite of what they could have won the three that they lost. And they could have lost the six that they won. You know, I'm not a believer in, well, it evens out or whatever. What I am a believer in is that you know, when people look at it and say, well, you know, the Falcons and the Seahawks blew those Super Bowls against the Patriots. Well, they did. That's exactly what happens in football. It's more about what you don't do than what you do do. It's about the plays you don't make as much as the plays you do make. So understand that that's kind of what makes the Patriots unique and special, because they're so well prepared for every situation, so well coached, that they don't usually make those mistakes that cost them games. Not always. They do sometimes, but for the most part, they don't. Other teams tend to. Falcons, Seahawks probably should have won those games. They didn't, because they made mistakes. Player mistakes, coaches' mistakes, issues that cost them the game. While New England, again, doesn't tend to do that. And it took, if you think about it, some big-time plays, even in the Super Bowls that they lost. They lost to Tom Coughlin's Giants twice. It took some unbelievable plays to beat the Patriots. The Tyree catch, the Manningham catch were huge factors, and it's not like they were blown out by the Giants, but it took almost superhuman efforts. And you talk about defense and the importance of defense. Those Giants defenses won them those games. Clutch plays by Eli when they needed them, but good defenses, which is one of those, was against those that great explosive offense that we're that I just talked about with the Patriots. Well, that got them there, but a great defense beat them. Great defensive effort. Those two get to great plays there. And then Philadelphia last year, I mean, it was a story for the ages and a Cinderella story in a lot of ways with Nick Foles and Doug Peterson, and it was a great story. But if you forget about the story for a second and look at the chances that they took, did the Eagles, and, you know, the Philly special play, other plays that they were aggressive, they attacked, and they executed, huge. I mean, they probably don't win those games. So, you know, again, it was, to me, a game that I see, I have the appreciation for what it was all about. Okay, I'm going to get into the game and talk a lot about the breakdown of the game for you to give you an understanding of truly what happened in the game. Then I want to spend a little time talking about recruiting, because, folks, listen, here's where we are at LandryFootball.com. And this podcast, the football playing season is over. But my God, I don't know how I'm going to get all the information in to the website and on this show, because there's more stuff to get to than there's time to do it. Of course, the new league year in the NFL starts. So let's maybe start chronologically. We've got signing day tomorrow. We've got the majority of players have already signed in the early signing day. We've got stuff that is coming out today that I've worked on and had that we're going to put up on the website today. It's going to break down every recruiting class of all the schools, all the Power Five schools by conference, whose class looks best going into signing day. And then, of course, we're going to have a recap of everybody's class once it's done. Now, it's not going to be up on Wednesday. We want to let everybody come in and everybody settle in and get all the paperwork in. And we're probably going to get to that closer towards this weekend. Well, we'll have everybody's class, their grades of the players in the class, what the grades mean, and we're going to have that. At some point, pardon me as I still get over this flu, we're going to have a breakdown of the players of as many of these classes as possible. We're scouting reports on every one of those players that they sign. So we're going to do a lot of that. Now, that's going to come over time, but we're going to breakdowns of the classes are going to come pretty quickly. Here's what we also got going on. Now that the season's over, the grades are, you know, obviously been done to this point, where I'm going to break down in the NFL position by position every player in the league, how they graded out. So we're going to have that for you to get you ready for free agency, which is right around the corner, so that you know how players graded out on your teams, on other teams, players who might become free agents, might not become free agents. You know where they graded. So we're going to have that for you. And then, of course, we're going to keep you up to date on all the latest information around the leagues on what they're thinking with regard to free agency. Of course, as we're doing all this, we've been, you know, been working very hard on the draft process all year long, but we're going to be focusing a lot on gradually getting our draft reports out, getting scouting reports out, so that you can have an evaluation of all these players in the draft, how they stack out, what the grades mean. And, you know, this is what this time is for. From now until, you know, the start of the season, it's about keeping you up to date on what roster changes are being made, evaluating the roster changes, evaluating the rosters, and getting you prepared, evaluating the teams, looking ahead. If you know me well enough, you know, it's not like, hey, I think school ABC is going to have an 8-4 season, or next year they're going to win the, you know, the NFC East. It's not what we do. What we want to try to do is take you in a little bit more detail, an understanding of the moves, why they're good, why they're not good, and get you prepared. Get you prepared and understanding what's going on, the good, the bad, the ugly. So that's what we've got coming up for you in a long-range plan for LandryFootball.com. We've got our postseason savings still up. That's, folks, going to be the last opportunity for you on that. So check that out. Take advantage of that, because it is the best savings. I mean, it's 50% off what it normally used to be there for a full year. So take advantage of that, and you'll get all that information: recruiting, the draft, free agency, coaching moves, roster analysis, all the latest inside scoop. That's what we got for you. You can catch this podcast every Tuesday and Thursday, the Landry Football Podcast, and then the Rush the Field Podcast every Wednesday. And then you want to make sure that you are on board for the free, yes, free War Room newsletter that you get right in your email box. All you got to do is provide me your email. Just go right onto the website, LandryFootball.com. Go to click on War Room, send us your email, and we'll put you in the system. We'll have some inside information that's not fit for publication that we will have for you, that I come across in my consulting work. So you can have that at your disposal, as well as keeping you up to date on what's going on LandryFootball.com. So take advantage of that now. And if you've got a question, we've got a couple of questions that we hope to get to today, time permitting. If you got a question, we always answer them here. If we can't get to them this day, we'll get to them the next podcast. We'll work through them. Just hit contact Chris, send me a question. We'll address it here on the podcast. So we're going to get into the Super Bowl and try to get some time to go into a little recruiting information of what we're looking for on tomorrow. Okay, want to talk a little bit about the Rams offense versus the Patriots defense. I'm going to talk a lot about that. I want to go over things that I saw that I thought were pivotal into the success here. The Patriots in the game ran a lot of stunts and twists. Okay, stunts and twists is when you interchange responsibilities with your defensive lineman. Instead of a defensive lineman coming at you straight ahead, you'll have a defensive lineman vacate his spot, go into another gap, while another defensive player loops around, comes into his vacated gap. What it does, it creates a little confusion. So the overall big picture of this Patriots defense is they wanted to stop the running game, and they want to put this game in the hands of Jared Goff, and they wanted to create confusion and pressure consistently. They ran a lot of those twists. They played really good coverage. I'm going to get into the type of coverage that they played. What they really did is they played man coverage on one side, then they played zone coverage on the other. Gilmore playing, holding up man against Cooks. But they basically force Goff to hold on to the ball. The twists cause a lot of confusion for Goff, so he held the ball too long and allowed the pass rush to get to him. And the twists work so well because, you know, when people say, well, why don't everybody run twists? Why don't everybody do it? Well, it's not just what you do, but how you do it, how well you do it. It's kind of like a blitz. I mean, you can sit there and blitz all day, but it's how you run your blitz, how you run your twists. It's the technique of what you do, not that you called it. It's you got to know how to run it so when you call it, it works. And the twists work so well because they work the edges of the offensive line so well that it engaged the offensive linemen so long that they couldn't, it prevented a switch against the looping rusher. So in other words, basically what you have to do against stunts offensively is you've got to be able to recognize the loop and be able to adjust to the second guy coming in. Well, it's kind of like when we talk about, use the term, a running back pressing the hole. Well, when a running back presses the hole, what we mean by that is you run it in and you suck the defense in before bouncing it out. If you don't, then they can stay and get good pursuit angles on you. Well, this is the same thing that applies, but it applies with protections. It applies with being able, when you can run that twist and engage the offensive lineman long enough to where he's got to account for you and he doesn't have enough time to switch off, then you've got a free rusher coming in. So it's not, well, there's a protection mix up. No, it was an ability to figure out how to adjust and get off the initial block into the second one. They did a really good job. The Rams offense couldn't get the crossing routes open. So they tried to adjust to the deeper curls and comebacks, but the rush pressure curtailed this. Goff never got in a rhythm because the Patriots never took their foot off the gas. I mentioned this during the breakdown of the conference championship game and the preview of the Super Bowl, that the Saints took their foot defensively off the gas against Goff. Everyone thinks that the only reason why the Saints defense had success against Goff was because of the noise in the Superdome. Now, that had a lot to do with their communication issues, but the Saints were aggressive and attacked them. Then they backed off a little bit, and then Goff started to develop a little rhythm. They completed a few passes, and his confidence came up, and he played pretty well. What Belichick learned from that game was, do not take the foot off the gas. Keep him down. Keep him on the run. Keep him confused. And if you do that for four quarters, why can't you? If you do it for two quarters, why can't you do it for four? That was the mission. That was the plan. We're going to get into some of the details why. The Patriots focused on defending the crossing routes. How did they know how to do this? Very simply. Jared Goff this year, and for those of you that are members of LandryFootball.com, you saw this in the breakdowns of the Super Bowl game and the breakdowns of the playoff games. We explained this in detail for you. Give you a little bit of a tease into what we do. Jared Goff this year graded out as the third best quarterback in the league completing passes between the numbers. Grading them out in that area. Okay, not overall, in those areas. Third best. That's his security blanket for Goff and McVay. All season long, they focused on max protecting and scheming guys open over the middle where Goff's vision was more comfortable. As I explained in the pregame breakdown on LandryFootball.com, the Patriots were aware of this and study intently what the Detroit Lions did with success against Goff this year. And, of course, that was done by former Pats defensive coordinator Matt Patricia. This is where, you know, you have to look at things. You know, people think, this team wasn't very good and the Lions weren't very good. And what do you learn from that? You learn a lot from every game, success or failure, as to what happened. As I mentioned, they learned what the Saints didn't do in the second half defensively, and they certainly saw what the Bears did, the Lions did, and all the games in which the Rams struggled. That's why we did a special on LandryFootball.com of leading into the game, what the Rams didn't do very well in their losses and how they might be attacked by the Patriots, and what the Patriots didn't do very well in their losses and how the Rams might attack it. If you go back and look at it and study, you see the Patriots were able to do that. The Rams didn't. The Patriots entered this game plan for 2 weeks. Their plan was take away the running game and defend Goff's security blanket, the passing game between the numbers. So they played with five defenders down, occasionally six, by placing the Sam and Will backer on the line of scrimmage, closing close to the line of scrimmage to close down those outside zone runs. Those backers are playing on the line. They're squeezing down, so the Rams can't get their favorite outside zone run going. Then they played combination coverages, as I said. They played man coverage to one side with Gilmore and zone on the other with specific design to take away the middle of the field first. Okay, so there were opportunities to make plays outside the numbers. The Rams couldn't get there because the pressure taken away which would made Goff success. Well, he had a lot of protection all year. He was the third best quarterback in the league this year, throwing it across the middle of the field. Well, with Mac protection and with time to throw and a good running game, they were able to get that done. But they mixed this in with some man-free looks, and along with this, they brought all those stunts and twists that we're talking about to get pressure into Goff's face. Pressure in the face and taking away your passing comfort zone. It was a tough game for Rams and Goff. We know that Goff played a whole lot better without pressure, without rush pressure. Of course, we know that's the same for all quarterbacks, right? But some quarterbacks can pick things up quicker than others and deal with rush pressure with differing levels of success. The Rams protected Goff very well this year. And when they did, when you play teams that weren't as good rushing, he flourished. That showed up on film all year long. We broke that down all year long for you. What also showed up on film was the fact that under rush pressure, Goff's production fell to 25th in the league. Okay, so you've got a guy that's played grading out one of the best in the league. Under rush pressure, he falls to 25. 25 out of the league's 32 starting quarterbacks. Now, that drop is precipitous and not indicative of how maybe some of the top quarterbacks in the league are affected by rush pressure. They're able to beat blitz pressure. I do believe that Drew Brees would have had much more success against this blitz look. In fact, I can tell you that Belichick would not have played with the same front. He played essentially some of what he did when he was a coordinator with the Giants, which, by the way, was before Sean McVay was even born. Just to give you an idea how long he's been doing it. He would have played it differently against Brees because Brees would have handled, and the offensive line of the Saints would have handled the twists a little bit better, and Brees would have handled a little bit better. So the Patriots, knowing that Goff struggled, used the twists and stunts on 18 of his dropbacks. That led to 9 pressures and 3 of the 4 sacks on him. One of the 4 sacks did not come off of twists and stunts, but the other 3 did, and 9 pressures in the 18. 12 out of 18. Pretty good percentage of being disruptive, I'd say. Keep in mind that the Patriots this season had only 30 sacks, which ranked them 30th in the league. They also were below average with their pressures. Situational football is what Belichick does best, and though they had not pressured the quarterback effectively this year, he knew that against this offensive line and against this quarterback, he would able to be to do so, and he had the 4 sacks. Having coached with Belichick, I know the way he likes to attack offensive lines that he feels are subpar is to rush 5 or use a linebacker as a ghost in the 4-man rush because it still forces one-on-one protection. Patriots blitz 50% of the time, while the Rams stayed in their 11 personnel. Why? That's what the Rams do. They couldn't get, you know, what they did was successful all year, but their inability to modify and adjust affected them negatively, no doubt. Pardon me. They couldn't get the running backs and tight ends involved in the passing game. Some of it was due to keeping those guys in to help with protection. Some of it was due to Goff's vision under pressure and not finding them in a timely fashion. I thought the Patriots' blitzing was exceptional. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of fans, a lot of media don't understand the technique of blitzing. People say, you need to blitz more. No, some cases you need to blitz more. In some cases, you need to blitz better. Some cases, they don't blitz because they don't have good blitzers. They don't have players that can execute good blitzes. That's like saying, you should throw deep more. If you got a quarterback that doesn't have a big arm, you can't. You know, you got a big power running back that's an inside runner that doesn't have speed to get to the outside. You know, even the average fan knows, well, why don't they run him outside? Well, he doesn't have the speed to get to the outside. But people don't understand oftentimes. They just think blitzing, that if you just blitz, it works. No, it only works if you execute it well and you have good blitzers and you can teach those blitzers properly. Okay, spacing and timing are the key elements to effective blitzing. Again, spacing and timing are the key to making them work. It's like route concepts. It's like pass routes. You know, your spacing and your timing, if you run two routes up into the same area and you're easier to defend because you got more defenders in that area, it's not good spacing. You know, if you're running a pitch on an option, you understand that you need to have good pitch relationship between the quarterback and the back, don't you? Makes sense, right? Same thing applies with blitzing. I don't think people understand that. Spacing and timing is essential, and it was exceptional. They did a great job. So Belichick and his defensive staff through film study understood what made golf successful and what caused them trouble. When people say Belichick takes away what you do best, it refers to the overall team, the units within the team, but also individual players. So he put this game on golf, on offense, and then took away what golf is comfortable with to make him uncomfortable. They did that by taking away the run. So the overall game plan was to limit the Rams' explosive plays by forcing them to work the ball down the field methodically. The Rams lift off big plays all year long. Bill know that. If you took that away, you had to have them beat. The first half was the worst in the McVay era. 0 points, 2 first downs, 57 total yards, 32 passing yards, 6 punts. 2 years. It's the worst his offense has been in a half. So he went into the game, did Bill, saying, we've got to stop the run. How do we do that? We're going to play Sam and Will Backer on the line of scrimmage. Okay. Golf will not know if we're bringing them or not. We're going to squeeze those Sam and Will Backers, which are very good against the run, both of them. And we're going to squeeze down the outside zone and take away the run game. So they're going to have to rely on Goff. What's Goff going to do? Well, we're going to put pressure in his face with stunts and twists, bring some blitzes, and what is he going to do? Well, he's going to go over the middle. That's his comfort zone. He's not comfortable going outside, particularly against pressure. He's not good in pressure. He's not good going outside. When he has time, he's okay. Under pressure, he's not. So what we're going to do is we're going to squeeze the outside zone with Sam and Mike Backer on the line of scrimmage, stop the run, force Goff to win the game with the pass. We're going to stunt and twist up front. We're going to blitz. We're going to put pressure in his face. And we're going to design our coverage to defend the middle of the field where he wants to go. So now everything is out. Goff is hesitant. That's why he's holding the ball. Hey, people are saying, get rid of the ball, get rid of the ball. He got nowhere to go with the ball. He's going to throw the ball outside. He doesn't want to take a sack, but he knows that he throws it outside under pressure. It could be intercepted. In a close game, you know, sometimes it's just, you know, you got to find a way to throw the football away so you can punt in a low-scoring game to have a chance. But Goff was confused the entire game. He was confused, and the thing that made him successful, the play calling, the play design, his performance was taken away. Simple as that. Now, I want to talk about the Patriots' offense and the Rams' defense. I thought the Rams' interior rush pressure this year was the best in the league. They had 154. That's the most by any team in the league this year. Their defensive tackle, Sue and Donald. Meanwhile, the Patriots only allowed 42 interior pressures all season. Okay, Dante Scarnecchia, as he always does, the great offensive line coach of the Patriots, had a masterful plan to neutralize Donald and Sue in concert with offensive coordinator Josh McDaniel's play design. Aaron Donald had one hit on Brady early in the game, and that was it for the most part. So you got strength versus strength, and who won? the Patriots won that. Now, it also, it's not just the offensive line play. It's Brady getting the ball out quick, working the short passing game. Getting the ball off three-step drops prevent the pass rush from getting there. So that's how you work your offensive line to fit your quarterback and your quarterback to your offensive line. I can tell you that the Patriots offensive coaches told me they thought they could run the football on the Rams inside backers. They thought that was a weak link to the Rams. So the Patriots wanted to run power out of 21 and 22 personnel, two backs, one tight end, two backs, two tight ends, because this got the Rams defense into their base personnel, and they wanted to throw out of this look. They wanted to throw them out of this look because that's where they had the matchup advantages. Thought Wade Phillips, he played a lot of different coverages, played more zone early, as he did more as the season moved along, but he played a lot of cover zero, man coverage with free safety help, bracketing Gronk inside and out. The zone allowed his defenders to eye Brady a little bit more. They had some success. They did not defend Edelman well. Let me address that. You need to press Edelman. You cannot allow him a free release off the line of scrimmage. But if you do that, then you have trouble defending Gronk because you lose a guy that can play in and out coverage on Gronk, which they did. They played a lot of man free. So it's, you know, you're going to get beat by Gronk deep because Gronk's the deeper guy that can challenge you deep and down the seam. And so while people criticize it, and listen, it's true, they didn't cover him well. A lot of it was two things. The Rams' corners are big and fast, but they are not quick. They're a little stiff. So you can't match up with the quickness of Edelman underneath. They felt like if they could tackle well, they were willing to give away the underneath stuff to Edelman. That was the game plan. But they weren't going to let Gronk beat him. Well, as it worked out, defensively, I think if you told the Rams that they were going to hold the Patriots to 13 points, that was a masterful defensive game plan and one that would get them a Super Bowl championship. And it didn't work. Obviously, the offense was, as we discussed, not able to get it done. So that was the game plan that Wade had. Now, Gronk ate him up late, and we'll get into that play, but that was really the only time he really killed him because, obviously, most of this game was played in the middle of the field, not in the red zone. I thought the Rams played a good game defensively, and it's going to largely go unnoticed, as it often does with team that falls short. But I thought, like, for example, Peters and Joyner played pretty well. They forced some incompletions. And again, Edelman was the key, and that's the reason why they decided to play it that way. On that Gronk play, that was the difference-making in the score. It was a repeat of a play called early in which – the Patriots had the Rams coverage beat, but Brady was a tad slow in seeing it. So McDaniels set it up and ran Gronk out of an empty set with Edelman underneath and two seam routes inside. And Brady made the correct read that time, made a great throw, and Gronk, as he usually does, comes up with those plays. It was huge. Look, I'm gonna one final thought on the game. Everyone wants to break it down and talk about, well, you got to have this, you got to have that. As we go into the offseason and people are looking to build teams and, you know, how you do this and how you do that, there are things you have to have in pro football to win. Okay? I think that you have to have a quarterback that is someone that is very smart and can handle pressure. And listen, young quarterbacks, Jared Goff, for example, I think will be fine over time, but he's young. You've got to have a quarterback that's a flatliner. I'm not concerned about the guy that just gives this team juice. I want the guy that's a flatliner that's going to make plays under pressure, make good decisions. Okay, he's got to be able to move the team in two-minute drill, but he also has to be smart in making good decisions, protecting the football. Got to have that. Okay, you need to be able to run the football. You need to have a good offensive line so you can run the football. You need to have some playmakers. But complementary football is so important. You must play good defense. You know, people talk about, and people don't understand good defense today. People look at good defense as based upon yards. It's not yards. It's the ability to play good defense on third downs in the red zone, stop the run on early downs. You know, it's scoring defense. That's what it matters. In the end, if you want to build a team, you have to start in reverse. You have to start and say, how do you win football games? You score more points than the other team. Well, how do you do that? Well, we've got to have an offense that scores some points, and we have to have defenses that stop people from scoring as many points as we do. Okay, thanks, Captain Obvious. How do we do that? Well, we got to have a defense that can stop the run. You got to have a defense that can rush the quarterback. Okay, that's where it starts. You have to be a good tackling team. You have to play good in coverage. I don't think you have to have elite corners on both sides. I think you have to have safeties that are smart, that are versatile. I think you could play coverage a lot differently. You got to have the versatility. I would rather have the ability to play multiple coverages and to mix in zone and man when I need to than to spend all of my money on corners that can just line up all the time and just play man, and that's all they can do. And then they struggle here or there, and they can't break down well, and certain guys give them trouble. I want to have multiplicity on defense. But I want to have guys that can win at the point of attack up front, defend the runs on early down, and rush the passer, and get off the field defensively. You have to play good defense. Their games, this was a great defensive effort by the Patriots. It was against an offense that had been very, very good all year long, but been pretty predictable in how they did it. The Patriots beat the Chiefs, and they needed to score 40-some-odd points on them to win. That is what is the beauty of what Belichick and Brady and that crew can do. They can win games by 3 points, scoring 45 points, or win it by 3 points, scoring 13 points. In this case, they won it by 10, I know. But the ability to be able to do that is important, playing good situational football. So, I mean, I want smart, tough football players. And defensively, you better be good. Because if you are a team that's an explosive offense that can move it up and down the field, but you can't get off the field, it's going to be very hard to win a championship. It really is. You want to know how hard the Rams offense this year finished the season as the 11th highest scoring offense in the history of pro football. Not only did the Rams fall just short of winning a championship, but so did the other teams on the list. None of those 11 teams won a championship. On the other hand, the Patriots, while they had a top 10 offense, also possessed the 7th best scoring defense in the NFL this year. In the 53 Super Bowls that we've had played, you know how many times a top 10 scoring defense won the Super Bowl? 46. Got to play defense. Now, you define good defense differently than you did before. But, folks, without defense, you're not going to win a championship. All right, we'll put that to bed. And on to a little bit of signing day. We're going to, again, have a lot of stuff on the website about it. But it's going to be an interesting day tomorrow, a little anticlimactic. The top 100 prospects, only 13 haven't signed yet. Want to see about some key guys. Darnell Wright, a 5-star offensive lineman out of Huntington, West Virginia. Is he going to go to Tennessee? Hold off West Virginia? That's going to be one storyline I'm looking for. Jerry Anealy, the 5'10", 200-pound running back from Jackson Prep in Mississippi. Decommitted from Ole Miss. Appears to be potentially Clemson. He's got Major League Baseball in his possibility as well. Isaiah Saufserve, the big defensive tackle from Amite in Louisiana. Yes, it's Amite as opposed to Amit in Mississippi. It's an LSU-Alabama battle. He's going to go where his older brother will go. We'll see how this plays out. I think LSU's the likely landing spot. We'll see. Nick Cross, the safety from Hydesville, Maryland, DeMatha Catholic. Really good bill for a safety. Like him a lot. He's committed to Florida State, but is not signed. Dad likes Penn State. We'll see where this goes up. It's probably going to come down to those two. Henry Teotu, the linebacker from De La Salle in Concord, California. Looks like Alabama. Tosh Lapoy was a big factor in his recruiting, so we'll see how that plays. But I think Alabama, Oregon, one of those two. DeJuan Jones, a tackle from Ben Davis in Indianapolis. Big, big guy. Good basketball player. He's come on as a football prospect. Mississippi State, USC, Florida State, Michigan, TCU, Ohio State, Oregon, Auburn, Florida, Penn State. We'll see how this plays out. Maybe Ohio State comes in and gets him. We'll see. And Lance Legender, of the quarterback from Warren Easton in New Orleans, coming off of an injury. He's got a lot of ability. Tennessee, Florida State, Miami. Interesting to see where they go. Alabama, looks like they're going to continue and hold off everyone to have the number one class. I think the story is the fact that you've got A&M right on the heels of Alabama in the West. You've got Georgia right there with a class that's close to Alabama's. Rich keep getting richer. So if you're a school like LSU, you're going to have a great class, a top 10 class, maybe a top 7 or 8 class. You're going to be the third best in your own division. Clemson's had a really good class, 27 in the early signing period. Done a really good job in Georgia and Florida. 14 signees, commitments have come for that area. Notre Dame's 21 players, half are already enrolled in school. They missed out on a kid that's going to Washington, a really good safety, Asa Turner. But it's top 15 class. Texas has had a really good class. Oklahoma's had a really good class. Oklahoma needs a lot of help on their defense. Alex Greenwich is overhauling that side of the ball. Going to be real interesting. I'm particularly interested in seeing what happens out west. UCLA doesn't – they've been a low-committing program for a long time, meaning late-committing, excuse me, is what I meant to say. So I think, you know, finishing strong is imperative. It doesn't look very good. They've lost some guys. We'll see how they finish this up. It's a pivotal year, obviously, for USC, and this class is going to say a whole lot about their status going forward. So we'll keep you up to date on LandryFootball.com here. Want to get to a couple of questions here before we run out for the day. Appreciate it. Richard asks about the Super Bowl. What stood out in the game? Richard, we addressed the Super Bowl, obviously. So hopefully that answered your question there. Questions. He also asked, what's your scouting evaluation of was Logan Mankins coming out of Fresno State? He was a country strong run blocker with adequate feet with a good hand punch. And it's pretty much what he was. He was pretty smart, too. And Dante Scarnecchi did a great job with him. Kevin asks, he says, last week's War Room newsletter inspired me to ask a question. There you go. That's why you want to join the War Room newsletter. It's free. Go to LandryFootball.com, click on the War Room, and put your email address in. It says, can you explain the pros and cons if the Saints primarily use 30, 31, or 32 personnel when Alvin Kamara was on the field? Okay, understand, Kevin, when you're talking about personnel, you don't see three running backs in the backfield. Now, I know what you're talking about. Let's say the Saints use Mark Ingram in the backfield and Zach Line in the backfield. And Alvin Kamara is out in the slot. Well, that's not – and then they've got, say, Ben Watson in a tight end. That's not 31 personnel. You're – remember, Kamara in that position is now moved out, and he's a receiver. Now, we know he's a running back on the roster, but you can take a running back and line him up at receiver just like you can take a tight end. So if a tight end is in the game, but he's not lined up as a tight end, he's lined up in the slot, that's not lined up in a tight end position. Okay, it's lined up in a slot position. So what you're really trying to ask is, what would the Saints do if they ran 21 personnel or 20 personnel and Kamara was in at receiver? If you ran them all in the backfield. I don't know if that's what you're asking, or I'm not quite sure. If you have a fullback, Kamara, you line him up in an eye, and let's say you had Kamara in the backfield as well. Well, the advantages are minimal in anywhere but maybe goal line unless you're running power. But if you're running power, you know, what you can do is leak Kamara out in the flat on the goal line to catch a ball. That would be an advantage. The disadvantage is you're allowing the defense to compress in the middle of the field, so it's more disadvantageous to advantageous. Now, if you meant to say that Kamara's on the field and he's lined up, say, in a receiver in the slot, well, then the matchup is you're creating less guys in the box and you're able to run with power with a fullback with less guys in the box, or check to the throw against a mismatch guy with Kamara against a linebacker. So in either case, whether you're talking about 20 personnel and you said 20 or 21 or 22 personnel versus, you know, 30, 31, 32, which you wrote, hopefully that gives you an idea of what it of what the difference is. Remember, though, and maybe I didn't express this well enough or explain it well enough, that when we talk about, you know, 11 personnel, that's one back, one tight end. You might have one of your running backs that's lining up at receiver. You don't count him as a running back. He's a receiver in that formation. He's a running back on the roster. You know, same thing. You might take a receiver. You might take a Cordell Patterson, the Patriots, who's a receiver, and they might line him up in the backfield. Well, he's part of the backfield, so he's part of the backfield numbers there and not receiver numbers, because even though he's a receiver in his position, he's lining up as a running back. Or, you know, again, a tight end that's lining up in the backfield as a running back, or a tight end that's lining up at receiver. So understand the difference there. So good questions. Really good job there. Remember, if you've got a question, send it here at LandryFootball.com. We'll get to it. Hey, off and running into the offseason. We'll keep you up to date and obviously break down recruiting on Thursday, as well as keeping you up to date on everything going on around the world of football. We're going to keep you up to date on everything and take you into the free agency period and to the off-season period with the draft and whatnot. So you want to keep it here at Landry, the Landry Football Podcast, the Rush the Field Podcast. This week on the Rush the Field Podcast, among the recruiting talks, we're going to talk about the state of the program of Kentucky football, go through its history, where it is now, so on and so forth. We're doing that with a different program each week. This week, we've done Syracuse, we've done Michigan, we've done Washington, we've got Kentucky this week. So we'll do one every week, breaking down the teams that finish in the top 15. That's how we're doing it on Rusty Field. So you want to check that out as well. And again, you want to take advantage of the postseason special that we have on LandryFootball.com. Talk to you Thursday, everybody. Have a great day.
To get more of Chris's knowledge, visit and subscribe to LandryFootball.com. You can also find him on Twitter at LandryFootball. This has been Landry Football on Radio Influence.
This is a Beyond the Badge with Vincent Hill Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
I'm going to move on and talk about this Jesse Smollett attack, if you will. And I'm going to break down why I feel there was nothing going on, just like a whole lot of other people feel that way too, but they're scared to talk about it in the mainstream media. There is video of him without the rope. And then in less than 60 seconds, you can see him walking into the building with the rope around his neck. So we would have to assume that in less than a minute, two guys wearing masks, approach him, punch him, assault him for several seconds, have time to get out the bottle of bleach or whatever it is, pour it on them. Like, first of all, keep in mind, think about this. I just said it was 17 below zero. Whatever would have been in that bottle would have been frozen already. it would have been frozen, just like when you see people throwing water in the air when it's that cold and it turns to ice immediately. So, yeah, in less than a minute, two guys come up, punch him repeatedly in the face, pour this bleach on him, tie a rope around his neck, and get away. Because, again, there's surveillance footage of him without the rope, and then less than a minute later, there's footage of him walking into his apartment with the rope around his neck. Now, he says he fought back. So either you're Bruce Lee and Mike Tyson combined, and you can fight off two attackers in 30 seconds or less, get back to your door with the rope still around your neck, and they get away. Man, that's pretty good. Like, I got good fighting skills, but I don't think I can fight off two people that quick. They get away, and then I walk in the apartment with the rope.
Beyond the Badge with Vincent Hill can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and RadioInfluence.com.